Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow here at Bruegel, the economic think tank based in Brussels. We are having our year-end roundup discussion with Bruegel's director, Jeroen Zettelmeyer, and senior fellows Heather Graby, Jean Pisani-Ferry, and Fiona Scott-Morton. You can find all of their bios and all of our fabulous reports from the last year on our website, bruegel.org. We are going to talk about some of the big events of the last year and some of the big events of the year to come. And to kick us off, Jeroen, can you tell us a little bit about your first full year as Bruegel director and where you see we've come from, where we're going?
So it's been a very exciting year. It's been a stressful year. Satisfying, I think, in that we managed to produce some impactful stuff. I think it was a different kind of excitement that from what we discussed at about the same time this year. So last year we were essentially in crisis management mode. It was all about energy. And now it's only mostly about energy, but not all about energy. I would say that the main shift is that we've gone from day-to-day crisis management to sort of the sense that we are facing some very, very serious medium-term challenges in Europe, some of which we knew about, others are new. But the real innovation, I think, is that as far as I'm aware, for the first time, there has been a very serious discussion and some serious doubts of whether the EU needs to adapt or change its economic model in order to tackle some of these challenges. And we can talk more about of this, but you know, just the basic point is if we are going to be a geopolitical actor, and you know, to some extent, that was what the von der Leyen Commission wanted from the beginning, then given how both our friends and our foes are developing, are the soft sort of rules-based tools that the EU has been proud of and that have been very important for the EU to manage its own internal divisions, are they enough? And how far should we go in moving away from those tools? And of course, you know, at Bruegel, we rarely have completely one-sided or radical answers. And so, you know, my preliminary answer is, we do have to revise some of those tools, but we should not throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Jean, we've seen tremendous amount of tightening from the central banks around the world, 10-plus interest rate rises from the ECB, the Fed, the Bank of England. How does this and the inflation that they were originally fighting against and now sort of trying to second guess as they move forward, how does this affect where we've come from and what's going to come up?
Well, they were late realizing the extent of inflation and the threat. They were forced to act probably too aggressively because, you know, monetary policy affects output and inflation with lags. And they were forced to act against the headline inflation, although they had no impact on the headline inflation. Now we've come to a moment where, you know, things are in balance. So the direction of travel is uncertain. What's not uncertain is the weakening of the economy, especially in Europe, in the UK also. We're seeing consequences of this policy are showing up. So it's not what I would have wished for, because I think that's not a moment where you want to be confronting your enemies or your rivals with a weakening economy.
Heather, how does this economic uncertainty play into the political upheaval we've seen? A lot of surprising election results this year.
And probably more to come as well. What we see is the way that the populist radical right is incredibly adept at jumping from one horse to another, depending on what they think will most scare voters, because most of their appeal is offering simple answers to complex questions about things that people are really worried about for very understandable and completely rational reasons. And the simple answers that they give depend on what it is that they think is going to attract the voters. So for a long time, it was, well, migration is at the heart of everything. Therefore, if we get rid of the immigrants, all the economic problems will go away. Now it's moving to, oh, it's the climate transition. That's the reason why energy prices have gone up, when in fact, the real reason is Vladimir Putin. We've seen a fair amount of that in a number of elections. We've also seen in the most recent election in the Netherlands a very interesting new phenomenon, a kind of fight about food security versus nature. It's a really bizarre turnaround given the science on how vital healthy soil is and water and all these other ecosystem services for actually growing food. But having succeeded in making the Ukraine war a reason to pull back on the farm-to-fork provisions that the EU put forward, we now see populist parties jumping into, farmers need to continue having lots of pesticides and fertilizers in order to ensure food security. So it's a very strange kind of set of arguments, but very effective so far. And I think the danger is that next year we'll see the whole green transition becoming even more of a political football because it's very complex issues. It's science, it's economics. And in political terms, right now, not enough political leaders are actually explaining to people the economic opportunities. Businesses are seeing them. The IRA has created a certain amount of FOMO in Europe, fear of missing out.
That's the US Inflation Reduction Act.
Yes, indeed. So the Inflation Reduction Act created a fear of missing out in Europe about the green transition and a new debate about competitiveness centered around the idea that we need to be able to have clean tech manufacturing in Europe. I'm myself not entirely convinced that this makes sense. Innovation we can certainly do, but manufacturing, it's hard to grow that with the level of cost that we have. But nonetheless, what we are now seeing is a new debate about economic security being very much enmeshed with other forms of security, including hard security. And that's really morphing thinking about economic policy. It's really interesting to see the way that after COVID and the war and now this competitiveness debate, it's no longer just about economic efficiency. It's about a whole series of other goals, from resilience to home growing and recreating manufacturing jobs, which is very confusing for a lot of economic policymakers.
Fiona, how do you see the EU making its place in the world? You've got the US on the one hand with its technology giants and its subsidies that are coming through this IRA. You've got China on the other hand with its manufacturing dominance. Where does the EU fit?
I want to just jump in on what Heather said about this confusing mélange of competitiveness and risk and resilience, and do we need to make our own products onshore or nearshore or friendshore? And the confusing aspect to it that I'd like to highlight is when competition policy gets mixed into that, and the idea that somehow all competition policy wants to do is cause there to be really low prices by importing some good from China, and that leaves us exposed both geopolitically and resilience-wise and so on. And to just raise for people that when you're looking to the welfare of consumers, consumers want not just a lower-priced pharmaceutical product, but one that's there every day. So the fact that the supply chain is very concentrated in one country that's not a reliable trading partner for whatever reason is an excellent reason to revisit how we do some of our economic policy or our competition policy. But it's not throwing out competition. It's saying we want more competition, better competition on quality, which includes resilience and things like that. So it's very valuable to try to pull out that thread from the mess that you just described. And that goes back to your point about politics. It's hard to describe something like that in a soundbite. I just tried, and it's really hard. So it makes for a difficult political environment.
Speaking of difficult environments, Chairman, what happens when the central bankers get it wrong?
I would say it depends on the context, right? It depends on the political environment. It depends on the fiscal response. It also depends on how they get it wrong, right? Do they get it wrong preemptively? Do they get the policy response wrong, right? So allowing a bubble to happen, particularly if you include sort of the macroprudential aspects of central banking, can have disastrous consequences. Global financial crisis. No, it wasn't all Alan Greenspan's fault, far from it, but certainly central banking had some role.
Housing, subprime loans.
That's right. That's right. So trying to solve social problems with low interest rates, these sorts of things can have, you know, tectonic consequences. The type of mistake that we are making, or that we have made, arguably, now are not in that league, I don't think. But if to the extent that they are, that they reach into that league, I would say that, you know, I would be a bit more worried, even though I agree with Jean that likely there has been too much tightening too fast and we will have a downturn as a result. Yet I think that the bigger of the two crimes was the late reaction, because that this will have consequences beyond a recession. It will have to do with the so-called cost of living crisis, right? It is the distributional impact of that. It's the fact that it is also unequal with respect to age groups. It's about how it affects housing costs. So these are directly things that add to the pre-existing social strains, strains caused by the green transition, fiscal strains. Of course, fiscal room is tighter now as a result of higher real interest rates. So those things, I think, really add to our burden. You know, the recession is not going to be good. If it happens, it will likely happen. But that, I think, is the bigger piece.
And when we add fiscal into that, it may also make sense to revisit the past year for Germany, which has seen some political upheaval and is now seeing some fiscal upheaval as it grapples with its budget and its economy that's flirting with recession and its ability to subsidize, but the frustration of its EU peers when it does subsidize. Heather, how do we put Germany into context here? And what is the political risk if Germany goes into recession for the rest of the place?
Well, it's a huge risk given the size of the German economy. But there's also a kind of bafflement about the German debate, which has been there for a long time, right since the Euro crisis. The way that that in Germany, economics is still seen as a branch of moral philosophy. And the degree of kind of moral disapprobation around issues of debt, for example, and which has now found its way into the German constitution as confirmed by the constitutional court, now causing a huge crisis in Germany itself over the budget. So there's been a lot of criticism at EU level of how many subsidies the German government has given through state aids, 50% of all EU state aids during the COVID crisis. And then suddenly we've swung to exactly the opposite side, where German ministers are having to find massive cuts in previously agreed programs because they have to meet the famous Schwarze Null. So Germany's fiscal gyrations, perhaps we could call it, will affect the rest of Europe, both through their impact on the German economy, but also on the whole debate about what is the role of the state and how much should the state be subsidizing. Here in Europe, we've had a consensus for many decades about the role of the state, mainly through the competition rules on state aids and the conditions under which they can be given, but also because there has been a pretty strong neoliberal consensus in most countries that subsidies in general should be avoided. Now, of course, they aren't always. And certainly during COVID, there was a certain turning on the taps. And also with the energy crisis last year, huge numbers of fossil fuel subsidies are still going into the European economy. So the question now is, how do we have a debate about what really makes sense in terms of public subsidies? What is appropriate in terms of public investment? And that kind of debate about first principles will, I think, start a new round of discussion about fiscal capacity.
Well, I think that there's going to be a renewed interest in competition policy next year because of both of what Heather and German just said. So this idea of state aid and subsidies, and is that making an unlevel playing field, and how can we make sure that we are promoting competition at the same time as supporting things that have externalities and that require this state aid. That's a giant topic of discussion. Another one is the cost of living crisis. I mean, I'm seeing other parts of the government that competition economists don't usually see being interested in competition enforcement because they realize if we could bring down the cost of some of these regular goods through more enforcement of cartels and prohibiting anti-competitive mergers, that would be really helpful for the broader attempt to address these problems. So I think competition enforcement is getting a big, I don't want to say lift, because I'm not quite sure what direction it's going to go in, but a lot of interest.
Jean, German, how are we still stuck in the is Germany the sick man of Europe debate? And what are the implications of that?
The difficulty we're facing that, Germany was the anchor country of the EU, and now Germany is a source of instability in a way, because I am not blaming the Constitutional Court to do what it has done. I mean, it has done its job, which is to remind everyone that if there is a rule, it has to be enforced. And if the government starts cheating with the rule through setting funds and hiding money in various places, then it's not a proper way to do fiscal policy. The difficulty that it arrives at a moment when we would wish Germany to be more steady in its action. So that's a source of instability. The other source of instability is obviously that Germany's big comparative advantage is manufacturing. It's the auto industry, and it's being destabilized by the green transition. So the question for Germany is being known how much advance China has gained in building electric cars, whether Germany can actually compete and or whether Germany has to suffer from the loss of its comparative advantage in excellent, outstanding internal combustion engine cars.
Yeah. So at one level, as a German, I probably have to be just a tiny little bit defensive here. At one level, the whole segment of Europe stuff is overdone. So if you sort of look at what is behind these segment things superficially, it is the fact that, you know, Germany had one of the weakest short-term output records in Europe this year. And that, you know, prospectively, German potential growth looks really bad. Okay, those are the sort of two facts. Now, the first one has to be seen against the nature of the shock, right? We had a very large energy shock in a country that is quite gas dependent. Given the size of the shock and the predictions, Germany did really well. It was a very mild downturn. As far as the prospect of lower potential growth is concerned, it's completely about demographics. It has nothing to do with China, with energy, none of that. Okay, so if that's the basis for the sick man claim, it's not very strong. Nonetheless, I do agree that Germany faces sort of enhanced challenges. And so challenge number one is indeed that China is a competitor for manufacturing jobs is going to hit Germany harder, potentially, in terms of the delta, than most other countries. Why? Because Germany has been sort of unusually successful in defending these jobs until now, and the automotive industry, of course, is this big one. So it has more to lose, and I'm also concerned about that. And then the other thing that, of course, is true and needs to be taken seriously is structurally more higher energy prices, which then is particularly bad for Germany because it has specialized in energy-intensive and semi-intensive industries based on a comparative advantage from the 19th century, largely driven by proximity to coal plants, and an uncanny ability to defend this comparative advantage after, or rather that industrial structure, after losing the comparative advantage in energy successively, you know, through essentially clever innovation and by importing first oil and then cheap gas. And so, you know, the question is, will they be able to pull it off for a third time by massively investing in green hydrogen, things like that, and importing this? Or should there be some change in the industrial geography of Europe? And of course, you know, from a European perspective, and I, from a professional point, have a European perspective, it should be something closer to the latter. So some change in the industrial geography of Europe, where some manufacturing moves closer to the energy abundant areas in the south, would probably be a good idea, at least some manufacturing stages. And that is very hard for Germany to accept. And that's where there is a potential conflict of interest between Germany and Europe at large, which is worrisome because it can lead to tensions. And at a minimum, it's going to be a pressure on resources, right? Because Germany will have strong incentives to spend a lot of money on doing stuff that, you know, is possibly good for itself at least in the short term, maybe not so good for Europe. And that's what we're going to have to manage. And, you know, that's where the whole constitutional court stuff throws in this extra spanner, right? Because the whole, you know, the famous Economist headline with the question mark, I think, about whether Germany was the Sigmund of Europe, again, of course, precedes the constitutional court decision. How does that affect that? Well, too early to say, but it makes it more interesting.
When we come back, we'll talk about the investment needed to get the economy back on track and hopefully fund the green transition. Welcome back. Jean Pisani-Ferry, your proposal on investment spending has been cited in almost every conversation I've been to about the investment that Europe needs to fund the green transition. So can you tell our listeners a little bit more about it and then put it in context?
It's not a proposal. It's a finding. And it's a finding that can be explained very simply. The basic way in which the emission can be reduced is by substituting capital for fossil fuels. So capital, if you think a minute about what's behind solar farms, what's behind a nuclear plant, what's behind a heat pump, what's behind an electric car, it's always the same. It's more capital and lower OPEX down the road. So essentially, the transition from an economic standpoint consists in investing a lot in order to reduce your dependency on fossil fuels down the road. So what it means is that there is a period that's going to be difficult, that's going to be challenging, because you have to find resources to finance this investment. I'm not speaking of public investment here. I'm speaking on investment in general, a large part being done by private agents, but the part which also needs to be done by governments, by public entities. But whoever takes responsibility for it, the economic effect is going to be temporarily adverse for consumption.
And remind us what level of investment we need.
There is a consensus around something like 2-2.5% of GDP per annum by 2030. So it's going to ramp up, reach hopefully this level by 2030, and then you need to maintain this level of investment for 1 or 2 decades, and then it's the transition is done. So the big debate is not so much about speed. The paradox is that if you put this transition in the context of the war in Ukraine, the tensions on the price of gas, and it's all good reasons to accelerate the transition. The big question is more about who is going to finance it and how the cost being shared between private agents and governments, and especially how much middle-class households are going to be supported, because there's consensus to say that lower-income households have to be supported. But I'm afraid, if you look at the numbers, also middle-class households have to be supported by government.
I think this is the political economy challenge, that this is a transition. So unlike fossil fuels, where you have to keep on importing them forever, there needs to be a huge capital investment now for much less OPEX later, as Jean was just saying. But explaining that to voters who have to make a choice every 4 or 5 years is quite difficult, especially at a moment of very low trust in governments. And I think there needs to be much more of what the Germans would call a Gesamtkonzept presented to the public, a kind of social contract around the climate transition, which has two elements that are currently missing. So one is the one that Jean just mentioned about support for governments to guarantee to lower income households in particular that they will have minimum income, that they will have support for the major investments they have to make personally in changing their heating system, insulating their roof, buying an electric vehicle, etc. And then the other element that is still missing is the projection of what it would be like to live in a low carbon to no carbon economy. there's no sense of that at the moment. You hear terms like sufficiency, sobriété in French, which are very necessary, but they don't sound very appealing. They sound like austerity all over again, which really hurt a lot of voters, especially in parts of Europe, which are now very vulnerable to populist slogans. So the need for governments to take a longer-term perspective and explain, we're going to have to make huge investments, all of us, personally as well as at state level, in the next decade or so. And then we're actually going to live in an energy-abundant economy, more so than now, which will have a new industrial geography, as German was just saying, but one in which there'll be plenty of green jobs because this transition is going to be very labor-intensive. In fact, what we have right now are severe labor shortages rather than unemployment as resulting from the climate transition. But this has not been explained. What's happening is measures are trickling out one by one, and then it's easy to shoot them down one by one without seeing how they add up to the transition to what could be, frankly, an economy that delivers better for the middle classes and the lower classes, which actually offers a higher quality of living with better air quality, water quality, better food, etc. But that's just not a calculus that is being presented yet.
And I think that description you just gave really makes it clear that a voter's age is a big factor in whether you think this is a great idea or not, because it really determines how he or she feels about the payoff here. Because if I'm going to invest for 20 years and then not be on the planet anymore, that doesn't sound very attractive. We had a holiday in Iceland recently, and it became very clear what this energy abundant future looks like. If hot water is essentially pouring out of the ground for free, and therefore electricity is largely free, the things you can do in an economy where energy is almost free are remarkable. The experience, though it was brief, in this very energy-rich and inexpensive environment made a big impact. And so I 100% agree with you, Heather, that if that feeling could be conveyed to voters, it's a very positive feeling. And it's a great investment because when you get to the other side, life is really a lot better for all income levels.
Jean?
Yeah, I think it's a very important point that at present, what dominates in the feeling of the citizens and the electorate is a combination of fear and helplessness. So that's really toxic. People are not in a climate denial mood. I mean, they're convinced that it's coming. They're convinced that there must be action, but they simply don't see their role in it. So they're left with this toxic combination of fear and helplessness. So I think it's essential for governments and for the EU to put forward a clear strategy and essentially to tell people what they can do themselves also.
Right.
German, all this money has to come from somewhere. On the one hand, we're desperately in Europe trying to mobilize capital markets. The U.S. capital markets are choosing where to mobilize all over the world. And on the other hand, governments are themselves trying to decide how much capital markets they feel comfortable using. Where are we going?
Yeah, so, I mean, Jean knows this better, but I think there are also some rules of thumb on the burden sharing between private and the public sector on financing. And I think that it is reasonable to say that you will need a significant ramp up in public investment. There may also be a role for subsidies in the energy transition, and that's also expensive. Now, Economics 101 tells you that if there is a trade-off between current consumption and the social benefits of future investment that will yield benefits in the future, then a way of ameliorating that trade-off is through public borrowing, right? So that's the proximate solution. It makes complete sense that if we're going to save the world in the next 10 or 20 years for future generations, that we do this through some degree of public borrowing. Now, the problem is that this public borrowing comes on the back of essentially three big crisis episodes: the global financial crisis and the Eurozone debt crisis, pandemic, and the energy shock that have all led to very high increases in public debt, including and particularly in Europe. And so what we need is, essentially a clever management of these problems. We need to find ways of reconciling high investment needs with fiscal sustainability. the European Commission has put a framework on the table that is, in principle, designed to do that. And at this time, we're not sure whether there will be agreement on a package, but I'm worried that what is agreed on will not leave enough room for the sort of public investment, green investment, that we need. While I am a complete believer that fiscal rules are first and foremost there to ensure debt sustainability, so everything else is secondary, there is a choice. We have a choice on whether to stick to what is necessary for debt sustainability, or on top of that, burden the rules by more or less arbitrary ad hoc rules of thumb that restrict debt financing of investment. And I think while the principle that some deference to investment should be given is consensus in the current rules, I think it has been pushed back in favor of, you know, ceilings on debt, requirements that debt should come down quickly, even when debt sustainability would allow a more gradual adjustment. And this, I'm worried, is going to constrain us.
When we come back, we'll talk about the digital revolution and what that means for everything that's coming. Welcome back to The Sound of Economics. Fiona, the EU has made such great leaps in its efforts to regulate the digital economy around the world, not just what's coming from within Europe. Can you remind people of all that's happened this year and then tell us how to think about it going into next?
Well, that's a hard question. But certainly we have legislation that is just endless, possibly in a good way, in Europe. There's the Data Governance Act, the Data Act, the Digital Services Act, the Digital Markets Act, GDPR, as everyone is familiar with. So quite a stream of legislation. Really nothing in the United States. And that leaves Europe in the position of being the rich world's regulator of the digital economy. Indeed, we had an excellent visit from Anu Bradford talking exactly about that. We have big problems to fix. We see that ex-Twitter keeps having more controversy with its owner, Elon Musk. We see that we have large language models that can replicate art that looks like a living artist. It can replicate a voice of a living singer. It can help you with your PowerPoint presentation. It can give you entirely fabricated information. So these are a lot of challenges. What is the European regulatory strategy going to do to combat and help people with these challenges? I think there's some cause for optimism. I think the Digital Services Act really is trying to make the internet safer for everybody, which is a fine program. The Digital Markets Act, we have an exciting development this year of designation of gatekeeper platforms, and then they will be in compliance in March, and that will be something that here at Bruegel, we'll be looking at closely next year, because there's a lot of potential innovation that could come out of the Digital Markets Act, although enforcing it will be tricky. So if that works, then that'll be a big change for Europe. It'll be a chance to be innovative, to host innovation, and to be on the leading edge of innovation. Other jurisdictions might gain from Europe's actions in that way, but of course it could all go badly too. So stay tuned.
Heather, any effort to get hands around the digital economy usually leads to some type of cognitive dissonance. For every improvement or safeguard that's put in place, there's often an inconvenience or a barrier or a user issue. What do you see as the big challenges, and how will, even when they're doing what will turn out to be the right thing, how do regulators convince people using this technology every day to go along with these new barriers or to work with the new environment and costs that it creates?
For the consumer of digital services and products, it's really tricky because you're aware that you've only got a limited number of producers. You know, you don't really have that much choice. And then when you go online, you are faced with false choices. For example, every time you open up a new window, you have to decide whether to tick the box of I'll just accept being followed and snooped on and all the rest of it, or maybe I'll go through another five windows in order to switch all of this off. And that is a great annoyance, and it is actually not a great advertisement for Europe as the super regulator of the digital economy, because we've all got fed up with GDPR having produced these boxes, and yet our data is still being misused by these giants.
So I have to jump in, because that is largely because of the Irish data regulator. essentially being on the side of the digital platforms and slowing down enforcement of GDPR. So we actually do not have enforcement of GDPR in Europe the way it was envisioned. And that then leads to discontent, as you say. It leads to more regulation because then you have to pass another law that puts the regulation in the hands of a different regulator, such as the Commission, or uses a different strategy. And I think it's a very interesting challenge for a first major jurisdiction to try to regulate these firms. And we have to ask ourselves, is it possible? And if it's not possible, that's quite an interesting discovery.
And it also leads to great frustration because the kind of whack-a-mole approach to, oh, here's another digital harm, here's another way in which we are being exploited as consumers, it doesn't increase trust in the technology.
Jean, what happens if there's a showdown between the regulators and the big companies? What happens to the economy if people start playing hardball?
I'm worried about this question because I think so far the EU has been able to do something extraordinary to be the regulator of the digital world without being a significant producer of digital platforms, content, etc. Is this combination stable? And I'm afraid it's not stable. I mean, there is a question first of the ability of the EU to keep up with the fast change in the digital technology. There is the question of the size of its market, which is diminishing. It's still important, but it's diminishing, at a relatively rapid pace. And there's this question of its agility, its ability to change regulation when it needs to. Being known that regulation has to be adopted by member state and that they have different interests, etc. So I think there is a risk there.
Chairman, as we close out this podcast, before we move to our predictions or perhaps one big takeaway for the year, could you just give us a little context on economic security and how we think about the many facets of dealing with China amid the context we've been talking about today?
Right. So the first point to be made is the one that Heather already made, which I think there's a general consensus that economic security deserves a greater emphasis than in the past. It's not that, safety growth trade-offs are new. So we had an extremely active debate around this after the global financial crisis. But then, the risks that we were worried about were at some level homegrown or maybe globalization related, but they had to do with financial innovation, credit cycles, and the behavior of systemically important financial institutions. Now what makes this sort of new is that it's more in the trade external area. And also we have this notion that it's mixed up with national security so that economic security risks could arise from essentially behavior of strategic foes. The second point to be made is that there are some policies that lead to trade-offs between growth and security, and there are some that do not. And so things that have to do with the efficiency and size of the internal market in the EU, things that have to do with trade integration that is diversified, possibly focused on friendly countries, these things are win-wins on security and on efficiency grounds. And so we probably should go for this. And so one sense in which I was disappointed in the European Commission is that when these economic security concerns started hitting home, and that was partly after Russia and due to the increasingly authoritarian nature of the Chinese regime, but ironically, they particularly hit home after the Americans passed this thing that we've asked them to do for a decade, which gets serious about climate change, right? But that's what really woke us up on the economic security stuff. So very ironic. But anyway, one of the things that the Commission failed to do at that point is to use the economic security angle to really get serious with member states in their slowing of reform in areas like capital markets, banking union, services integration, right? Because that would have been the low-hanging fruit that you could have justified from a security angle. Instead, we have a big revival of a debate on industrial policy, which I do not completely disagree with. So I do think that industrial policy has a role to play, but there you do then get into those trade-offs. And so basically then the third point to make is that if you are in an area where there are trade-offs between economic security and other broader policy objectives, you have to be very precise about what exactly are the security threats, how do you address them best, because you might make big mistakes if you go the wrong way.
Looking ahead to next year, I think the elections are going to be the big story. We've got EU elections in the middle of the year. A number of countries are going to the polls. And outside Europe, the US, of course, has an election coming up. The other thing I think I personally think will be really important is if the central banks can get this soft landing right, or if they succumb to their fear to not want to miss inflation again and overdo it, because central bankers are much more embarrassed when they miss high inflation than they are about overshooting, in at least historically. Fiona, what's your big prediction or thought heading into next year?
I think the interaction of this security concern, national security, economic security, industrial policy, and competition is really a tricky one. It's intellectually tricky. It's extremely important for outcomes in these elections. It needs to be untangled so that voters get offered something that is constructive and helpful and gives them a better quality of life, which is hard to do. And I think academics and policy people actually have their work cut out for them trying to figure that out.
German?
I think the next commission is going to have a tough time. It will have a tough time partly because of what might happen in the European election. And of course, what we fear will happen is something a little bit akin to what happened in the Dutch election. So basically that the middle will be squeezed. And we are very lucky in Europe to have had a strong middle in the European Parliament, a very strong, committed, pro-European middle that goes all the way from the right to the left and the Greens. And so this would make the Commission's life much more difficult, because at some level we need, and the Brussels perspective needs to be, a bird's eye European perspective. If we lose that, you know, then it essentially becomes a negotiation among member states. And that's going to be terrible. I mean, that undermines the basis of the EU. And of course, what would be even more terrible if that negotiation starts to happen inside the European Commission. I'm very, very confident that this would not happen in the next commission, but there is a risk. The other reason, actually, I give you two more, of why the commission will have a tough time is...
And the next commission comes in when?
The next commission comes in, I think, in September, right? For good, that's when we will know. The other reason is because of something I think Jean and Heather may have alluded to, which is that some of the trade-offs that I mentioned, also the trade-off not just between economic security and growth, but between, you know, green transition and affordability, consumption, these trade-offs may start to bite in the next few years. And you know, we are seeing, if you like, the political reflection of that in member governments becoming increasingly worried about their green transition commitments, something that my colleagues may want to comment on. So maintaining those goals and doing the actions that we need to reach them may be more difficult in the next commission. And then, you know, the final point, of course, is like many, many Europeans and also many Americans, I worry about a return of Donald Trump. But I leave that to others.
Heather?
Well, I think that it is very likely that the populist radical right will make further gains because people are really fearing a large range of things. And this could have a profound impact in several areas, especially if it comes out through the European Parliament elections, which are always second order elections where people feel they have a kind of free vote, which doesn't affect too much politics at national level. So they often tend to go more radical. And in 2019, they went more green because there was a rise in turnout for the first time ever since 1979, as many young people came out to vote, and they are so much more green, the under 30s. 30s than the older generations. And the danger is that they may stay home this time because they, ironically, feel that the green transition has not gone fast enough. They are disappointed with the slow pace at EU level as they see it. And meanwhile, older voters will vote radical because they feel that it's going too fast. So that generation gap may well play out more strongly in the European Parliament election than it does in national ones. And the populist radical right could undermine several very big EU projects and the EU's role in the world. First of all, by simply undermining the EU as a community of law, what German was just referring to as the EU's own rules-based order. You know, you have populist radical right commissioners. That makes it much harder for the commission to be the guardian of the treaties and the referee of the single market. It may empower then some of the, you know, governments that wish to violate the rule of law at national level as well. Secondly, it could, of course, then undermine EU support for Ukraine. And if that's then combined with a US election result, which does that too, it could be an absolute disaster for European security. It could also change European responses to the physical impact of climate change, which should speed up decarbonisation, but it could lead instead to a very protectionist and kind of let's put up the barriers and save what we have kind of response. And finally, of course, it could make things even more tricky in terms of navigating the response to the US-China rivalry.
Jean?
I strongly agree with most or perhaps all what has been said. Let me add another point which hasn't been mentioned so far, the perspective of enlargement. We are committed to negotiating with Ukraine, with Moldova, with all the states of the Balkans on enlargement, and it's becoming even more important as the war in Ukraine the situation on the ground is stalled, and so any weakening of the commitment on the part of the EU would resonate with what's happening in the battlefield. So I think that's really important, and the conditions are not going to be auspicious to moving forward and giving timetable, giving reality to this commitment because of the internal situation in the EU and because Trump, if he's elected, he's not going to help us in this regard. So I think that's major. And it in principle, enlargement questions the nature of the EU because it will be the first time that enlargement will be completely driven by geopolitical consideration. And that the economic criteria, the legal criteria will have to take the back seat. So it's in this kind of situation, it's really important to know what you want. I'm afraid it's not necessarily what the EU will be in a position to do.
Something we may be discussing this time next year, if we are here in this group, and Mr. Trump has been reelected, is the reaction of the EU to that and how much
it will be a big story should it come to pass.
How much additionally are we able to and willing to do, particularly for Ukraine? No, but that would be a watershed moment.
Thank you, colleagues, for this conversation. We're here at Bruegel. I'm Rebecca Christie, speaking with Heather Graby, Jean Pisani Ferry, and Fiona Scott Morton. We're all senior fellows, speaking with our director, Jeremy Zettelmeyer. Thank you, listeners, for sticking with us at Bruegel throughout the course of the year with this podcast and also with all our many reports, events, other productions that you can find at Bruegel.org and many of your favorite distribution channels. We hope to see you next year. Thanks again. Have a good one.